spot.
I want to make sure I hit that recording button because sometimes you blow it. Have you ever done it, Anne Moriarty?
That's right. Very good. Very good.
Wait, who was that? Was that in Sherlock Holmes?
You got it. Hey? Professor Moriarty.
Professor Moriarty.
A nemesis.
Was that one of your distant cousins?
When I lived in Hawaii, I used to tell people, think of it as two short Japanese names. Moriarty.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good. Well, I'm so glad to have you, Anne Moriarty, here on the edge with me and my brains. Brains, we are back at the spot. We're at the place here where the conversation is pointed, the guests are sharp, and the responses are never dull. Look at that. You are here on the edge with me. Let's hold that up together.
All right.
Look at you. Oops, a little blur there. That's all right. So thank you so much for joining me here on the edge. You're still out there in Boulder, Colorado?
I am.
What you doing in Boulder?
Well, I have a couple of things happening. I have family out here in this general area, and I have a family coaching business that that's not what brought me out here. What brought me out here a few years ago was returning to my hometown, because I grew up mostly in Boulder, and then I had lived away for all of my adult life, and I wanted to be back near my parents, you know, as they went into their older years. And I'm very glad that I did, because my mom passed away a few years after I moved back. And I was just very, very grateful to have that time with her. And then now I'm helping care for my dad, who has dementia. So,
bless your heart.
And so some of my sisters live nearby, and I'm getting reconnected with them. And I just love the mountains. So,
Well, I've never been to Colorado.
Well, that's the place
I want to go. I always fly over it, you know, but I've never actually stopped and landed. Family is so important to you, and you have a great story. You're going to tell us how many sisters you have as well. But beyond that, you have dedicated this portion of your life to really work with coaching families. What does that framework look like? How do you coach a family?
Well, the way that I do it is a little different from other people that I've come in contact with. I engage the entire family, not immediately, but at the beginning, I generally hear first from a frustrated mom. And she's saying, this is not how I expected my family to be. I can't stand it anymore. I can't stand the way we talk to each other, or the way I get all agitated when they get agitated, different things like that. And so then she comes to me generally, and then I start working with her. And this is the program that I have in place right now is a year-long program, because these habits did not develop overnight, and they're not going away overnight. So
let me just stop you there. Just 1 second. Hold that thought though. Coaching for a year. Now, and I have to ask this question because my brains are going to want to know. Why not just do talk therapy or family group counseling? Why get a coach?
Well, one of the reasons is because I bring in energy exercises. And that was a huge piece of my healing process. I had done a lot over the years, you know, healing this, you know, they say peeling the onion, this layer. But some things just were still stubbornly sticking there. And when I found energy practices, that's when I was really able to leap to a new level and to just really integrate on a much deeper basis. So the energy practices help everyone calm down right away when you use them properly. And then over time, the energy practices help us overwrite the patterns that have been developed in our brains. And I was so excited when I first found your podcast because I love to geek out on brain stuff. Now, I'm not some like neuroscientist or anything, but I love learning about the brain. And I first started learning about it when I was working with young children. So to circle back to your question, it's that this is a holistic program. So it's giving parents and children new strategies, new perspectives, and it's giving them a place to try it out. So I start out with the adults and then I bring in the children and I meet with them individually and teach them some of the energy practices. And it's very tailored. So some of the meetings are a small group with other clients, and then some of the meetings are individual. And that's really been the magic sauce, is to have that combination of some time with a small group to realize, oh, I'm not the only one
right
that's going through these kinds of things. And then the individual ones to say, well, this is what's really getting on my last nerve right now.
And I've got a laundry list of things. I was just sitting up here looking. I do a brain dump often and regularly. I just get a bunch of stickies and a whiteboard and go nuts because I want to open up that capacity. I want to open up that space for other things to travel through. A lot of times, you know, we're like a bad drain. We're clogged.
Exactly.
And there's people that don't want to move. All the players don't necessarily want to play together well in the sandbox. I get that. But it causes a lot of dissension. Now, let's talk about family from a different dynamic. Tell my brains how many sisters you have, Anne.
I have 9 sisters.
9 brains. 9. Now, all of these are your biological. You guys all grew up together?
Yep.
Now, what was that like?
That was, of course, like anything else, it had its pluses and minuses. There was always someone around to do something with if you wanted. And there was always somebody around when you wanted to be by yourself. So like anything. But one of the things that really shaped who I am and why I ended up on this journey is that my dad, as long as I can remember, had a volatile temper. And I love my dad. He's a good man. He did many good things as a dad. And he never learned how to control his temper. And I found myself when my first daughter was young, and I thought to myself, oh my God, I'm turning into my dad. Now, not with her, but with my husband. I was married at the time. And I realized all I had done was flip the genders. I just said, no man's going to treat me that way. And then I was treating him the way that my dad used to treat my mom. And so that whole anger piece was my big challenge, was how to manage that. Because for a while, I just went along with this philosophy of, well, that's just how I am. Like, take it or leave it. And then I just said this to my ex-husband the other day because we were talking about something family related. And I said, you might be surprised to know how many times I have said to other people that you saying to me, I wouldn't speak to a dog like that.
Whoa, I've heard that before.
Impact. That landed eventually with me. And I looked around and I thought, oh, other families don't do it the way that my family did, where my dad would blow up and then my mom would be very placating. And she was a very calm, loving, giving person. And she was also nervous, I learned later, for her children's well-being. So she didn't want to push anything further. She didn't want to. I said to her, why didn't you just tell him, go out for a walk? And she said, I was afraid he would get even more agitated and something worse would happen besides just the yelling. And so what I started to notice is, oh, other people don't speak to their spouse like this in public. Other people don't speak like this, just whoever's in range gets the blow.
Mm-hmm.
No. And so that started to make an impact. And then my daughter asked me recently, what made you decide to change? Because we were talking about this same topic, and I said, seeing the fear on your faces. When I would blow up, and again, it was rare that I blew up toward them I would get upset, but just seeing them looking like,
right.
Is mom gonna, is she like really gonna get really upset again? That's what really made me say, no.
Right.
I'm not
you know, there's families that like drama. They get off on that. They literally enjoy the combativeness, almost to the point where it's premeditated, you know, like before Thanksgiving. People are getting, just like they're purchasing the turkey and the yams, they're getting their attitudes. Well, you know, Uncle Bob's going to come and he's going to get drunk. And then he's going to talk about his ex-wife and she's going to start to cry. And then my stepmother's going to show up. And I mean, they already wind themselves up for this kind of activity. And I find it disheartening, especially when they add in the combination of substance abuse, yes. That liquid courage. And my mother used to say all the time, she says, I wonder why alcohol makes people act such a doggone fool. Why can't it make you nice and sweet and kind? And I said, you know, I don't know. So what do you say to a combative family? Where do they begin to start the conversation of change?
Here's a really huge piece of that. And I'm so glad you asked this question, April, because those kinds of behaviors are addictions, the same way we can be addicted to a substance, the same way I have been in my life addicted to chocolate. This is something that happens in the brain. It's a chemical reaction. It's your brain chemistry at work. And so just like anything else that's addictive, over time, your tolerance builds up and you need more to get the same feeling. So what really happens is when it generally happens when we're younger, we're in an environment where this kind of eruption might occur, and that starts to feel normal. And so then we feel normal when we are around that. So our brain starts to seek that out. And when it's not there, it says, oh, well, I'm following directions and this body, this person is telling me I feel more comfortable, more normal when I'm in uproar. Mm-hmm. So what can I find to get in an uproar about? Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. So it really comes from the amygdala. It's a large part of it is from the amygdala in the center of the brain, which is the 911 call center, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And that part of our brain has several functions, but two of the big ones are memory and emotions. Mm. So what happens is something happens to us. It gets coded into our brain as high priority emotionally. And then there's another piece that's, I'll go on to biological imperative in a minute, but what happens then is the amygdala is always scanning. Is it safe? Is it safe? Is it safe? That's safe. Okay, don't worry about that. That's what I found super fascinating. Why do we get so caught up in the negative? It's because the safe isn't affecting our life. It's not affecting whether we're safe. So, okay, that person's okay. No big deal. This one, my attention goes here. The more my attention goes here, the bigger that flag gets in our brain to say, Uncle Bob, I'm going to look out for Uncle Bob. And if he makes one move
direction, I'm going to pounce on him like Tigger.
Exactly. But the other thing that really helped me so enormously, April, is that I learned some things about what scientists call biological imperatives. And that's just a fancy way of saying things that are wired into us. One of the things that's wired into us is to pay more attention to the negative because it might be dangerous. Mm. Positive, okay, no problem.
Because you jump immediately into the fight or flight.
Exactly.
Right. So yeah. I have to automatically protect myself. I have to automatically defend. I have to automatically fight. I have to automatically debate, demean, diminish, squash the enemy. Mm-hmm. But what they have never done is taken the preventative measures to reframed this situation with mm-hmm. Uncle Bob before he even gets there. Maybe he's had 6 months of sobriety and you're ready to pounce on him.
Right.
People do not allow themselves. They get so compartmentalized. They are so polarized in this negativity, in this space, that they can't see the forest for the trees. They don't understand, in my opinion, what real love is anymore. I asked a family member of mine, what was love? And had he ever been in love? And he told me he didn't know. It broke my heart.
Well, the other thing too that happens is that we start to label people. And again, that's a biological imperative. If you aren't strong and with your tribe in the wild, you're going to be dinner for the predator. Mm-hmm. So you've got to stay with your tribe. That's one of the reasons that we have some of the race issues that we have in the world, because we are biologically geared to feel safer with people who are like us. Mm-hmm. And so that we're working to overcome that with a lot of really wonderful people who know about this. But the other thing is that we are, one of the biological imperatives tells us that, no, one of the things that we tend to do is label. Oh, my dad is a hothead. Mm-hmm. So when my dad blows up, oh yeah, there he goes. But the 5 other days that he comes in from work and is calm, those don't get paid attention to.
Right.
Because my brain is saying that, number one, he's not dangerous, so we don't need to worry about it at this moment. But also my brain is saying he's a hothead. Mm-hmm. It's the same way I think when parents learn, don't tell your children things like you're clumsy or you're not smart enough or something like that. The more we say that to something, oh, you're shy. Oh, you're so shy. Oh, look how shy you are.
I am the one that tries to break the proverbial shell. This is a timely conversation because I just ran into a situation where, you know, dealing with children that are not your own. And I'll tell you something, Ann, I don't have the patience for the nonsense. I just don't have it. I am about to be 60 years old and I am unapologetically me. I love to give you your space, but I want to have a conversation with you. I want to understand where you're coming from. We don't have to be coming from the same direction, mm-hmm. but I want to be able to set my barometer, to be able to gauge where you are so I can adjust myself. But when you're trying to play these head games and, you know, the don't talk and, you know, always in the device and distractive, try to start a conversation, I lose my patience and I'm out of there. I'm out of there. Am I giving up too soon on these opportunities? Again, because you're shy or don't force them to talk or this, that. But no, I can't communicate with you any other way but verbally, mm-hmm. you know. And if the verbal doesn't connect, I'm not going to reach out you with physical, because that may be even more intimidating or unwanted. I'm confused.
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because there is another way besides verbal. It's energetically. So let me give you an example. So I go, let's say I am going to my sister's house and I know that her grandchildren are going to be there. And I decide ahead of time that I remember that this one granddaughter was behaving a certain way and I didn't like it. So I'm already in my mind telling myself the story, kind of like you said about Uncle Bob. And I'm thinking, oh, she's going to be like this. And if she does that, I'm going to say this. Our energy then is saying, we have an energy bubble around us. Some of the research shows that our energy can be read up to 8 feet, even up to 25 feet away from us.
Wow.
And I do experiments to show this to families. That's one of the things that I do, is constantly sort of prove to them about things. So I'm sure that you and everybody else who's listening has had at least one time in their life where they have thought, they have felt like the hair on the back of their neck stand up. They didn't hear anything. They didn't see anything, but they're like, something's not right. And then they turn around and they see somebody near them, or you're in an elevator, particularly for women, we're in an elevator and someone gets on and we're like,
I know, you judge them as soon as the door swings open.
That's not necessarily judging though, April. It might be your energetic body saying, and it's not necessarily that they're going to harm you, but they might be feeling angry. They might be feeling upset. They might be feeling depressed, and your body reacts to that energy. So the same thing happens with children. So one of the ways that you can create better communication, easier communication with children of any age, is to go in with your energy where it's inviting to other people. Now, the devices are a different story. That you have to talk with the parents about and say, can we make this agreement that the first 10 minutes I'm here, whatever. Because the devices are addictive and they're designed to be addictive. And so these brains, these young brains are like soaking it up. So we're teaching them to be addicted at a very young age. So that's a different thing. But if it's just like you're sitting at a family reunion, or you're talking to somebody outside after a Sunday service, or if you have a faith community, whatever day it is, and they're kind of like this, if we make assumptions about, oh, look at how, you know, that boy doesn't even respect me, won't look me in the eye. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily. We're making a lot of assumptions and judgments, and our energy is hitting that child's energy. They notice it, even if they don't know it consciously. Our energy in a way is sort of assaulting them. Mm-hmm. Instead, if we go in, there's some questions that are just fantastic to ask other people, not just children. Instead of, hey, how are you? There's so many questions. I give people practice in asking those kinds of questions.
Okay, well, give us a few.
Okay, so one is to say, hey, oh, I know you went to camp this summer. Can you tell me one new thing you did at camp? Instead of just saying, how was camp? Or you could say, oh, you know, I heard that you really like making movies. I'm really curious. Those are really helpful words. I wonder and I'm curious. I'm curious, like, do you have like a certain kind of movie that you really want to learn how to make? They might say anime. They might say, who knows what they say. But when you use that kind of language and you indicate that you're curious and not in this really, hey, how's it going?
Yeah,
you can really get a different response from them, or so, you can use humor.
Frame your question, you know, not so open ended, but tailor it.
And tailor also
that you're asking a question within a question to get multiple responses.
Exactly.
And create dialogue. And I've done that too. But sometimes it's like watching paint dry. Yeah. And I want to go back to something that you said. This was odd to me. Me and my husband, we go on our weekend date. We go to breakfast. And we pull up, and this car pulls up on the side of us. And I go, and he goes, what are you sniffing for? I said, that I smell the energy of this woman in the other car. And I said, baby, I don't like her. There's something about it. It's not good. And he's going, really, April? He says, you're smelling the pancakes we're about to eat. I said, no. No sooner than I said that, we go in, you know, this is the great resignation. Nobody wants to work right now. The hostess was also playing waitress. We had to wait. We saw this woman running all around. The other woman comes in and immediately she attacks her. You didn't acknowledge us. You didn't do this. Her energy had an odor. Okay.
Wow.
It was strong. And my husband goes, you pegged that right away. He said she wasn't even out of the car. I said, because she was exuding this energy. So I get what you're saying. You're a strong proponent on the brain, body, and heart connection. Tell us a little bit about that.
So really what that means is that they're all tied together, and that the more that there's several aspects to it, but one of the key ones is that the more that we can come from our heart and from that attitude of, I would like to connect with this person. And then that's the heart energy, which, you know, can flow out. But also the brain, the heart regulates the brain more than we ever knew. We always thought the brain regulated the heart, but research also has shown that the energy of the heart can be, I want to say, 500 times stronger than the energy of the brain.
Oh, I believe that.
I don't have the numbers right at my fingertips because I haven't, this is kind of older information, but what happens is that when we can align our heart and our mind and our body, that's when our energy is really flowing and grounded at the same time. And also for most people, motivated. They're motivated to do something. Right. And this is so, so important with children, because they are looking to us to know their place in the world, among other things. And when we can wrap our arms around them, literally and figuratively, with this loving energy, we're human, so it's not going to happen 100% of the time. That's obvious. But when we can do that most of the time and say, say things like, that was really hard for you, instead of, stop crying, you're such a baby. When we can surround them and acknowledge, then what actually happens is their brain chemistry stays more regulated. Mm-hmm. So if we want ourselves and our family members to be regulated, we start really from the heart and we say, okay, like I did with my daughters, I don't want them to have this fear about me. I know what it was like to grow up with that. I'm not doing this anymore. What's my first step? And that's, so it's this, we're holistic. I mean, everything is all connected.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it takes work, and you gotta be big enough to be patient.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we don't have, is patience. Because you've got to pump the brakes. Your emotion is going to trigger. That's the first thing, because we are human. That's the first thing that's going to happen, is we get emotional, we raise our voice, we get in your face or whatever. And it takes us a few minutes to dial back and allow that other person to enter into the space to create some balance. So what I've tried to do really is just kind of take that deep breath before, be an active, engaged listener.
Exactly.
Silence speaks volumes,
mm-hmm.
especially with children, because they are absorbing what you're, you know, they're little sponges. They're absorbing your energy and they're trying to figure out, you know, how am I going to play this? What strategy am I going to use? So I just kind of dial back, let them do it, but I'm only going to play that game for so long.
Why is that?
Again, I guess I'm just at this particular juncture in my life where I've raised my children. The rules of engagement are different now. I wasn't ruled with an iron fist. My parents were real cool. A lot of conversation. I could probably count on one hand how many spankings I ever got. The dialogue was great. Never any hanky-panky. So it was really good. And I think that's what I set my barometer at, was peace and harmony. So when it goes too far to the left and there's chaos and there's, you know, substance abuse and there is this negativity, you know, I don't give it a lot of energy, which maybe because I'm able to be a little bit more balanced, I should give it a little bit more. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I'm going to invite you to consider two things. One is, don't ever should on yourself. You could change your behavior as opposed to should. But the other thing is that it's generally, when we withdraw in situations like that, it is fear on some level. It does not show up as fear. It shows up as judgment, anger, anxiety, in certain cases, depression, withdrawal, but it's based on some fear. In particular, when people around us, and let's just talk parent-child, when our child gets really big with their emotions, we, generally speaking, a lot of people don't know what to do with it. They're afraid they're not going to be able to handle it. They're afraid it's going to get out of control and never stop. So they want to put a stop to it. Mm-hmm. Go to your room. Come out when you can smile. We don't talk like that in this house. Instead of being able to hold that and say, wow, this is really scary for you. This, you feel really angry. Your face is showing me you might be feeling sad. I'm here. This is the thing. You asked earlier, like, how I help families. So one of the things that I do is I give them information about the amygdala and about, you know, things like that, like how things work in our body and the patterns, how the patterns develop. I also help them build their awareness. I have created these different checklists for how do you respond in with anger, guilt, joy, anxiety, the seven major emotions. And then also the energetic practices. And you said earlier about stepping away because it takes a few minutes before you can step away. But once you practice and you have success with, oh, wow, doing this pivot exercise or taking a certain kind of breath or tapping or holding this gamut point. So I give them all these strategies to use in the moment. And I also ask them, where does it happen and how do you learn? So what I mean by that is, does it happen mostly in the kitchen and the family room? Okay, how do you learn? Let's put a note up. If you're a reader, put a note up that says breaths, gamut point, tap, whatever is appropriate. Or if you are a visual learner, we're going to find a picture and you're going to put that up in the area where these disagreements or these explosions tend to happen. And then you can go, And the other thing that I tell people all the time is say to your family, I'm trying some different things. I don't want to yell as much as I've been yelling. I don't like it. And I know you don't like it. I'm trying some different things. Help me remember by, you know, can become a family thing. And I've had some families that I've worked with who've come back to me with some fantastic success stories where the children said, mom and dad in one situation were starting to get agitated because something had happened on the trip. Things were not going well. And one of the children said, maybe if we all just stop and take a breath. Like those are the kinds of things that can really, really make a difference. But it starts with giving people information and strategies and practice. We practice a lot. And then also helping them to develop their own awareness. That's a huge piece. And that's one of the hugest things we can do for kids. Children, sometimes if they're in environments that are stressful in any number of ways, they learn to disconnect a little or a lot from their body. So you can ask them, how are you feeling right now? I don't know.
Oh, that I don't know wears me down. You know. But again, maybe they don't want to verbalize it, but that's another way to shut you down. That's another way, okay, well, if I say I don't know, they won't continue to ask these questions. What do you say to a family that is broken or blended? You're bringing in a lot of other dynamics. You may not be able to use some of these strategies. What would you say to those type of families to really try to create a safe space to start a conversation?
Well, the first thing I would say is it only takes one person to change the dynamic. Even if nobody else agrees or nobody else knows what one person is doing, let's say mom or dad comes to me and says, I need some help. I want to shift some things, but I'm not ready for a fight I think I'm going to get on this. Okay, we're going to work just privately for that period of time. And the more that that person shifts things, their energy changes, people notice. And one of the things that happens, which I tell them about, is when we are in a so-called dance with someone, and this is the way it's always been, you do this, I do this, you do this, I do this, and now you do this, and I don't do that, this person is going to try to pull me back in. So that's, but then once you know that, you can just stand to the side and go, oh yeah, that's what Anne was talking about. Mm-hmm. They're trying to pull me back in. And I have these strategies to help myself stay out of that. And there's, I mean, I could talk about this for hours, but.
Well, how did you get so smart, Anne? Are you a coach? Are you a psychologist, psychiatrist? I know you've got a lot of life experiences, and with 9 sisters, girl, please. I can only, now, did you have any other siblings? It was just 10 girls.
10 girls.
Wow.
In 11 and a half years.
Well, daddy wasn't angry the whole time.
That's for sure. So I am a coach. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a social worker. I'm a coach, and I have, I'm a former certified conscious discipline instructor, which is where my journey began. Well, not exactly. That's where my journey began with other people's children and learning a lot about the brain and heart connections. But I'm also a certified expert professional life coach. And that was several degrees of life coaching training, and a former anger management specialist. So I just kind of pulled all of this together and said, along with my life experience, and said, oh, the other is the energy practice. I'm not certified in any way with that, but I just saw what an enormous difference it made for my life. And I wanted to share that with other people.
And the thing of expectations, brains, we have to work on that. You really can't have a lot of expectations of anybody. What you can only do is set your barometer for you and be open to change that frequency to accept people and meet them right where they are.
Exactly.
You know, and because you're not going to change overnight.
And be curious. The more that we can come from, I wonder why that person did that, instead of I'm going to fight them about it.
Right, right.
And sometimes I'll say, I wonder why this is happening. You know, we're human. So we're going to get irritated and so on. But still, those words are different than you always, you never. If you say, I'm not understanding, I wonder, I'm curious, tell me more.
Right. The vernacular and the lexicon is huge.
It
is.
The
choice of words, because mm-hmm. verbal abuse can be sometimes more tragic than physical abuse. It is ingrained in your subconscious mind. It carries on through epigenetics, you know, past generational trauma of, you know, grandparents. I'm looking at a certain situation, and I see 3 generations that precede these young children where there's unresolved issues and there's secrets.
Yeah.
Now,
and that's why
how do you feel about the secrets? Because I know there's a time and a place for everything, but I think for little people to really grasp a sense of who their parents are, what the world looks like, being honest, I think that some of those secrets should be revealed, don't you think?
Well, I'm not really clear on exactly what kinds of secrets you're referring to. Can you give me a little more information about that?
Just overarching, you know, there might have been sexual abuse, there might have been alcoholism, there might be gambling, there might be, you know, mental health. that nobody then, even talks about.
Then it has to be age appropriate, of course. You're not going to talk to a 3-year-old about the fact that you were sexually assaulted when you were 15, you know.
Right.
But what you're going to do is you're going to buy books and you're going to show little cartoons about my body is mine. And when I say no, it means no. And that means I don't have to hug grandma if I don't feel like it. We get into all those thorny issues. Secrets. There's a lot of ways that secrets can come up and be healed. One of the things that I think is really important is for adults to deal with their own stuff first, because then when either if you read or you do workshops or you work with a psychiatrist or a coach or somebody and you, or a faith leader, and you come to understand, oh, this is what, this is the harm that was caused to me. This is how much I've been able to release. And this is how much I haven't been able to release. And this is how it's affecting my life. You can have a very different conversation than just saying, like my dad used to say, he used to say all the time, don't get in trouble. You're going to get in trouble. It only meant one thing. You're going to get pregnant. I'm like, what is that about? Like, right. We never talked about anything about, I didn't learn anything at home about sex. Hardly. My mom was a nurse and didn't even talk with me about having my period. We had a little class at school, but my period didn't start till like 5 years later. Mm-hmm. And so there's these things, and I totally understand and empathize with both of my parents because I see where they came from and what was given to them, that whole generational trauma thing you're talking about. But once we decide about our own secrets and then decide what is developmentally appropriate, then we can find ways to bring it up. Something comes on the news and says, so-and-so, this man has been accused of sexually assaulting someone. Then you can bring it to the dinner table and say, you know, what do you and your friends think about this? Like what you can just find ways that are age appropriate to say, maybe not have any of your friends, you don't want them to rat their friends out, but to just say, do you feel like you have the language? Like if somebody pressures you, do you have the language? Or you get them connected with someone who's one step removed from you and let that person have that conversation, somebody that you trust. The thing about secrets with little ones is that I always used to tell parents, the 23 years I had my preschool, I would say, we don't do secrets, we do surprises. A surprise is we got this cool thing for daddy for his birthday. It's a surprise. You know, lock it up. Don't say anything. But if we say it's a secret, I think it's confusing for children because then somebody comes along and says, this is a secret. Don't tell mommy and daddy. And they're touched inappropriately or something grievous like that. We need to make a real strong distinction between surprises and secrets.
I totally agree. You are a wealth of information. I could talk to you forever, and I could tell my brains how to get in contact with you. I love for them to work with you and to really do deep dive because you're just so easy and mellow and just, you know, the voice inflection, which is huge because you're going to meet me where I'm at. And I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, people can get in touch with me several different ways. I'm on Facebook. I have a private Facebook group called Own Your Happy. And you just ask to join and answer a couple of questions and you can join. Or I'm also, you can find me online. My website is annemoriarty.co and it's not .com. So it's annemoriarty.co. And I always offer a free 30-minute consult for people just to ask questions and see if things feel like maybe I could be a support to them, maybe not. I am really committed to sending people to the resources that will work best for them. So if I have any sense that I'm not the best resource for them, for instance, if someone comes to me and their family or someone in their family has experienced a deep trauma, I am not the person to start with. That is not a safe place for them to start. They need, and I'll put them in touch with someone that can help them with that. But anyway, so people can connect with me, and I really invite people to do that 30-minute free consult, and they can find the link for that in my Facebook group and on my website.
And on the back of this interview, absolutely, because I want people to reach out and not just touch you, but embrace you. You don't know what you don't know, brains. And there is a lot of trauma that
yes,
is surfacing, resurfacing, unresolved. People are not happy. But on the flip side, there are wonderful people that are happy. Because I'm happy, even though I kind of pull back. But that's for my own sanity, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want to be combative or combustion on anybody else. So I, you know, pull back and make it easy on you.
You do what works for you. And that's the thing, is that I really, I've been toying with this idea of changing around my business name to include something about hope, because that's really what it comes down to. Every time I talk with a parent or grandparent or teacher or somebody else who works with children, is when people lose hope, then there's no chance for things to change.
Right.
But when they can have hope that this idea or this strategy or this starting point, this one step can make a difference, that's really what it's all about, is the hope. And I've seen families make huge changes where the yelling is almost gone. I mean, we're human again. And the nightmares or the night fears for children are gone. Or people, the two adults can say, I didn't like what you said to me. I want to talk to you about that, instead of getting into a shouting match.
And another thing that I noticed is the trauma is so severe that I'm seeing and hearing a lot of kids between the ages of 9 and 15 that are bedwetting still.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, I don't know. You know, and then there's a shame associated with that.
Yeah.
There's an embarrassment.
And that's a very definite fear-based or a disconnection from the body. That makes total sense, that if they're living in some sort of environment that creates a pervasive fear, whether it's small over a long period of time or a big something, then they get, for their own emotional safety, they disconnect a little from their body because it feels so horrible to be in their body because of that fear. So they disconnect. It's a coping mechanism and it saves them. But then they get older and then it's dysfunctional. It's no longer functional. That's when we start saying, thank you to our younger self. Thank you so much for protecting me. Now I have other tools. And I don't need to rely on this disconnection from my own body. And the bedwetting is a great example of that.
Wow.
I'm not saying that's the only reason that it,
right.
But on some level.
It is. Well, be aware of that and be sensitive to that, parents. Mm-hmm. Don't just attack and just, you know, cut off their water, but have a conversation.
Right.
See what's going on, you know, observe. And talk to them about that. Talk to them, you know, as a human being, as a young adult. They're going to school. Their peers probably know, or they're going over their friend's house and they wet the bed over there. It could be very, very traumatic, lifelong. It could be changing. But we are in the business of changing things for the good here on The Edge. So thank you so much, Anne Moriarty.
I think you
are such a gift to be able to share your knowledge and your expertise. Brains, go right here. You see this address right here? Undeniable. Okay. It is the podcast of the century. Greatest one on the planet, On the Edge with April Mahoney. Thank you so much, Anne. I'm going to put all of your information, the show notes in the back. We're going to rerun this a million times in private groups because it's important. You know, you don't have a lot on this planet, brains, that you can take with you, but the memories, the lifestyle, the gifts, and the love that you give a family member or family members will last.
And I think, April, the one other thing that I neglected to mention is people, especially I noticed during COVID, families were not as comfortable jumping into that long program. So I'm also starting a 5-week program so people can get a taste of it so that they can say, oh, okay, this is some of what I can experience, and then move on from there in whatever way works for them. But it's been my pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for welcoming me.
Absolutely.
All right.
Brains, just, you know, shine a light on love.
Yep. We're all in this together.
That's right.